When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bullen.
And we're back with part two of our hopefully intriguing Dale story.
Oh, that's right. We need to do a recap. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Noel, could we get some recap music? Previously on Car Stuff. No, I'm kidding.
You love to do that.
Cut the music. I love to do that.
That's your typical Lost intro, right?
You know, we have to be careful with that joke. I've made it so many times now. It's kind of antique.
You
know,
it's all right.
Worn around the edges.
It still works. Let's them know that we're up for part two.
Yeah. So, quick recap. Usually if you're listening to a multi-podcast episode that we do, we try to make them somewhat independent so that, you know, if you say, oh, I just want to hear the end or I just want to hear the beginning, that you don't have to listen to all of these. But if you have yet to listen to part one of our Dale Carr episode, you've got to stop now and listen to the first one. I'll give you a quick recap just to catch you up if you already listened. We're talking about a very strange car in the 1970s. Called the Dale. It was a three-wheeler with a motorcycle engine. It was going to, according to its promoters, revolutionize the car industry. The two key players in here are a designer named Dale Cliff, for whom the car is named, and the CEO at that time, the chief promoter of this, a lady named Liz Carmichael. And when we left off, they were at a point very similar to that of Preston Tucker when he was beginning work with the Tucker Corporation. What we mean by that is that they were financing their growing company by selling dealership franchises and stuff like that. They were also
offering stock,
which got them into a similar sort of situation that Preston Tucker had earlier, which is the government started sniffing around, and Uncle Sam actually, through a California business regulator, told them that they could no longer sell stock in their corporation. And when we left off, there was starting to be a little, what was the phrase we used? Trouble in paradise.
A little trouble in paradise, because that was when the car and driver photographer went to the Dale factory, supposedly, to meet with Liz Carmichael and see the Dale for himself. And what he found, Ben, was not all that impressive. You remember he found a vehicle that was surrounded first by guys that were scribbling on clipboards, you know, that had Clark Kent-style glasses on, you know, lab coats, I'm sure, that were trying to look very important as they're marking notes down on their boards.
No steering wheel.
Yeah, when they leave, he finds, no steering wheel. He finds a Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine under the hood of this thing. Realized right away that the entire thing was a scam, but that wasn't it, Ben. There was a lot more coming, and we're going to get fairly quickly to our big story twist here in just a minute, but he realized quickly, this car and driver,
Mike Salisbury.
Yeah, Mike Salisbury, the photographer, the reporter. He realized that this car wasn't even close to production ready. It was just, there was nothing that was right about this. The, you know, the manpower, the vehicle, the owner, nothing was right about it. And there's kind of a funny little story, I guess, about how he met the owner, you know, how he met with Liz Carmichael. He says that, you know, when he, after he's done looking at this vehicle, you know, there's a, all of a sudden in the, you know, one corner of the garage, there's the honking of an air horn and this big Lincoln Continental rolls up, and it was an exact match to Elvis Presley's personal car, except that this one had gold monograms. The door opens and a large woman steps out. Now that's Liz Carmichael. Remember the way we described her? She was like 6'2".
Yes, between 6 and 6'2".
Yeah, 225 pounds. She was a big woman, right? Tall. And, she gets out. She's wearing a pale yellow pantsuit, open-toed high-heeled pumps, and a long Shirley Temple wig. And she's got a cigarette in one hand, and she walks around the Lincoln to greet him. And she says, "Hello, I'm Elizabeth," but her voice sounded like that of Broderick Crawford's. Now, Broderick Crawford, that was, he was an actor from around that time. He did a lot of, police dramas, I think. He was an older gentleman. He had a deep, deep voice, Ben.
Yeah, right. That's the, that's the joke there. Now, it's weird that, I guess at the time, right now it sounds very, very sexist for us in the modern age to be hearing all these descriptions of this lady and dwelling on her physical appearance. But also you have to remember, that's part of the environment in which people moved at that time.
Yeah.
It was, I think it's probably very tough work to be a female CEO.
Probably. A lot of scrutiny.
A lot of scrutiny. And, you know, speaking of scrutiny, author Richard Smith, who was that friend of Dale's we mentioned in our previous episode, the guy who literally wrote a book on Dale, Richard Smith shares some of the concerns that Mike Salisbury carried, which is that he was skeptical about this project pretty much from the beginning because Richard worked at the GM assembly plant in California, and he understood that there were certain logistics involved in mass production.
Yeah, once you see a full operation of what it takes to make a car, then you realize if you look at, you know, what they found in the Dale plant, the supposed Dale plant, there just wasn't anything there that would imply that they're even intending to make vehicles.
Right. So, for instance, just to go off of this, one of the big things that you have to do when you're beginning to manufacture a car is you have to line up a supply chain way in advance.
Yeah, far, far ahead of time. And there's not just that. I mean, you've got to get the machinery in place, and you've got to get the manpower in place.
Right.
And there's just so much that goes along, all the licensing that's involved. I mean, it has to happen. And I'm going to say almost years in advance, really. I mean, you've got to lay the groundwork for this whole thing to really work. And all of this is leading to a point where, Dale Clift is finally beginning to open his eyes completely. Now, I know we mentioned that earlier that, you know, once the CEO claimed that this vehicle would reach 70 miles per gallon.
Right.
Clift said, "Wait a minute. I don't think that our vehicle can do that." But
he still kind of held
on. Yeah. I'll hang in there and see what you got up your sleeve, Liz. But once he finally said that, here's what kind of broke the straw that broke the camel's back,
when
Carmichael finally claimed that she had crashed a Dale into the wall at 30 miles per hour without being hurt.
Ah, but here's the thing, says Richard Smith. They didn't actually have a car that could go 30 miles an hour.
Yeah, so guess what this causes Clift to do? Clift, he leaves all his personal papers with Smith, so he's covering his trail, right? He's saying, here, I'm, if anything happens to me, here's all my personal papers and where to keep these. And he started carrying a handgun in his pickup truck with him at all times.
Which sounds like there's more to this story than we actually know. But at this point, we see things begin to unravel.
Ben, I've got to say something here. Okay,
yes.
So, you know, this is where a second cease and desist order is filed, right? So in December, the California Corporation Commission sets up a second cease and desist order on the company, you know, saying you can't sell stock, you can't sell dealerships, you can't sell distributorships,
right.
None of that, right? Well, we said that, you know, he's carrying this handgun and it's kind of, you said it sounds like it or hints at there's something else going on within the corporation. Well, in the same year, I don't know if this is in late 74 or early 75, I'm not sure, a Dale was on display at the LA Auto Show. It was on the floor of the auto show in that time.
Drumming
up attention. And the company's PR guy, who was back at the Encino office, was murdered, Ben. He was shot to death by another employee within the Dale Corporation.
Right. And this is what really, I think, was prompting Dale himself, Dale the man, to walk around strapped.
Maybe.
Because at this point, Liz and Dale have had a huge fallout, and Liz has essentially told Dale, hit the road, Jack, and this employee murder situation didn't do anything to help relationship.
All that heated up pretty quick, and there was a lot of pressure on Liz, you know, because what's going on here within the company. And, you know, also they're really starting to dig into, all right, well, where is your, you know, what is your supply chain? Who do you have lined up for, you know, the materials for the body shell that you claim is bulletproof, or, you know, the glass that's bulletproof rather.
Right.
Where are the engines coming from? How are you going to get those from BMW? And, you know, all of this information is just not, you know, matching up with the people that are investigating them. So the company moves its headquarters to Dallas, Texas in January of 1975.
Right.
And by March of 1975, you know, that didn't last too long. I guess by March of 1975, they seized all of the assets of the company, of the 20th century, what do you call it? The 20th Century Motor Car Corporation.
Yeah. Assets are seized.
Yeah.
The indictments are passed out. There are no cars, no factory, no prospects for future production.
Isn't that something? So Carmichael has really, she's fled the state.
Yeah.
She's been caught and she flees once again. You know, she gets away somehow. Now, I guess there's an article in People Weekly that kind of clears all this up.
Right.
And this is where the twist comes in, Ben, because she flees the scene there in Dallas, Texas, and she gets away. And I saw one description of this where, you know, as she left the house, they came in to raid the house and to gather her up, you know, to find her. And I think that the dinner that she had placed on the table for the night was still warm.
Wow.
So that's how quickly she got away. You know, it was like within minutes.
And then they found her in Miami, right?
Yeah.
Where she was under an assumed name.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
But before we go on to what happened next, let's take a brief pause. Let's feel the suspense, you know, let it ride out.
This is the big twist coming up.
This is the big one.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian. Someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day. Seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if we're being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource. And paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? I'll wait. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I guess we should get back to the show.
Yeah, you know what? Let me start by saying that, you know, when she fled the, you know, her Dallas, Texas headquarters, or where she had set up as headquarters.
Right.
She left behind a lot of different things. She left behind, now this is something that puzzled authorities.
Okay.
Some of these things that she left behind were wigs, hair remover, well-padded bras, and of course she abandoned the $100,000 home that she was in itself, which was unusual to begin with. And, they said that she shared this home with children as well, which I'm not
five
quite
children.
Sure. Yeah, five children. Now, this is where the mystery starts to, just starts to even unravel even greater, Ben, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens at this point?
So she is eventually spotted, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And arrested in Miami.
In Miami. So she's made it, halfway across the country.
Right. And it turns out that this widow with a $100,000 home in Dallas, was not actually named Liz Carmichael at all.
No kidding. What was her real name, Ben?
His name was Jerry Dean Michael.
His name?
His name. That is right. It turns out that Liz Carmichael, in addition to being dishonest with her investors about the Dale car, was dishonest with everyone about her real identity on so many levels.
Even her gender.
Even her gender.
Even her gender.
Yes,
so this is a man. This is a man all along. Again, Jerry Dean Michael, and he was 47 years old, and he's a fugitive, since 1961. He's been hiding out, you know, trying to live this lifestyle as a female.
Been a criminal the whole time.
As a way to get away, as part of a counterfeiting scheme that he was busted for, or should have been busted for, back in the early 1960s. So, this thing is a deception right from the very beginning all along. I mean, look back at everything we've told you, you know, now knowing that this was a man all along.
Yeah.
And things change a little bit.
Well, yeah, so they know it was definitely, Jerry Dean Michael because they have fingerprints from this earlier charge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, based on Carmichael's own comments, it seemed that she'd undergone a sex change. So this wasn't really, I guess, so much. You have to wonder, like, it doesn't seem as though it's just trying to assume a false identity to get away with a crime now so much as it sounds like a legitimate transgender situation.
Ben, but they found out later that there was no surgery.
Right.
And the only thing that was really happening, there was no surgery.
Right.
Yet.
Right.
But what had happened was she had taken just a boatload of hormones. And that gave her the female appearance that she was going for, I guess. And I don't want to get too deep into this because you can look into this as much as you want. But,
right.
What was going on was she hadn't had the official full on surgery yet. And I'm guessing, Ben, that a lot of this money that was, you know, being, you know, dredged up for the Dale was going to go towards that surgery. That's my guess.
Right. And it's the '70s. So this stuff is, just medically speaking, it's a very different environment. During her trial, however, she did ask to be referred to as a woman. She was granted, that right. And apparently as Jerry Dean Michael, she had been married.
Really?
And got divorced. So
this is all so confusing to me.
This is all out of the.
So when she's the mother when she says she's the mother of five children, he may have had five children at some point.
Right. Yeah.
Which, again, this is so tough to piece together looking back. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, if you got your hands on the original police files, it would be a little bit more clear. But,
yeah,
you know, the stories that we have here, they've got a few holes in them as far as, you know, looking back, you know, everything we've told you at this point, if you look back and say, well, this was a man, how did that happen? How did this work out? Pretty difficult. Anyways, you can piece it all together for yourself. Look up the story of the Dale. It's really interesting. But
right. So
this isn't the end of the story yet.
No, not at all. Because I'm glad you mentioned the police file because it'd be more like a police book. So Carmichael's legal woes, it's true, discrimination is rampant in the 70s, right? But Carmichael's legal woes have nothing to do with her gender. So we mentioned that as Jerry Michael, she had the counterfeiting conviction that ended up being dismissed, but she had more than two dozen charges of stock fraud, conspiracy, grand theft in LA court. No one knows exactly how much money was involved in the fraud that she pulled with Dale
because they couldn't find the way, well, they couldn't find the books to begin with. There were no books really.
It's all cash.
It was all cash deals. And, you know, they think there's a couple different numbers here. Now, Carmichael always hired bodyguards to carry away the money. So no one really knew what was there total.
Right.
And I guess they found orders for, they did find receipts for orders up to $2 million, for people that had invested in the vehicle. However, it's estimated that more than 5,000 customers were bilked out of as much as $6 million total. So we're talking about a $4 million deficit in what they knew was there and still couldn't find.
Right.
And, you know, what was there in reality, likely, and they couldn't find as well. You know, so she's got as much as $6 million, squirreled away somewhere. Right. Now, Dale Clift, you would think that he was getting rich off of this as well, along with Carmichael, right?
Yep. But he's not.
He was still kind of the innocent in this whole thing because, and I say innocent because he never really profited from it. He was involved in it, but he had his suspicions early on, and he was being duped all along just with everybody.
Right, yeah, he was being exploited as much as anybody else, but instead of his money being stolen, it was his dream, which I think is even more grievous.
Exactly, that is dream, and if you want to talk money, he did receive... He received two checks. He received one that was for $1,001. And that was, you know, part of what Liz Carmichael had promised him. You know, she had actually promised him $3 million total. And this was kind of the initial payment, right? Here's $1,001 as kind of good faith money. And then she gave him another check that was a $2,000 check, and that one bounced. So the $2,000 check never made it through the bank. But he was promised $3 million and didn't receive more than the $1,001, you know, for, I guess, the destruction of his dream, really.
Here's another thing. It turns out that when Liz Carmichael represented herself in court, she was actually really good at it.
Represented herself. You know who else did that? Ted Bundy. And, you know, he also did a reasonable job, I guess,
yeah,
if you want to say.
The
he was
dental
smart.
Records matched.
Exactly. And he was crazy also. You know, that there's also that. And so was Liz Carmichael.
Crazy,
but,
like a fox,
well,
bro.
Okay, so... I enjoy watching clips of people representing themselves in court. It's always pretty hilarious what goes on.
You love true crime,
well,
man.
Yeah, I do. But, you know, they say that, you know, like they say, Bundy was reasonable at representing himself. He was a smart man.
Yeah.
If you want to take that out of the whole story. He was smart, but, you know, he also was very arrogant. And I would guess that Liz Carmichael was smart, but also very arrogant.
Well, if you have the kind of... Maybe we shouldn't say mental disorder. That
mental disposition.
Yeah. Okay. There we go.
To think that you're so much smarter than everybody else, you're going to think that you can beat the law system.
There's a level of narcissism just inherent both in serial killers like Ted Bundy and in serial con men or con folk rather, and. One thing that's interesting, just totally unrelated. Did you see, I think he was a guy who was defending himself in DC for, some murders on a subway or something. Mm. He defended himself in court and I can't correctly recall this, but he accused over the course of his defense, he accused pretty much everybody in the room of doing the murders. So
wow.
He would question how do you know it wasn't? Can you point to the person who committed this alleged crime?
Yeah, this is part of why it's so entertaining to watch someone defend themselves.
And the witness would say, it's you. And he would say, are you sure it wasn't you?
Yeah, it's definitely an exercise in insanity, really.
Well, point being, it's also an exercise in arrogance, as you said.
True.
So this goes up, yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I want to say that, you know, during the court trial, she also... kind of, you know, draws parallels between herself and Henry Ford and Preston Tucker and other heads of industry, or Preston Tucker would have been a head of industry, I guess. But she draws these parallels that say, well, I don't see why what I'm doing is any different than what Henry Ford did, because he had an idea at the beginning as well. But he also had something to stand behind. He also had a working model of a car, which they never really had.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all.
All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian. Someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day. Seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if we're being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource. And paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? I'll wait. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Right. Like, as we mentioned in the conclusion of our Tucker series, at one point in the trial, they say, look, we're not making fake cars. They're parked outside. Hop in one and take a ride with us.
And by the way, I have another, I don't know, I'm going to make up a number, 15 that are still on the assembly line at my enormous factory that is now shut down because of this trial. If we could just wrap this up, I could produce cars.
Yeah, now it's fairly obvious from our references to Preston Tucker that Scott and I believe he was shut down by somebody else, maybe one of the big three.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not the case. This is not the best comparison,
well,
but she is persuasive.
And that's the angle that she plays along the way the whole time as well, that, you know, this is the big three coming down on her. And if you listen back to everything we've told you about, you know, the mock-ups of the cars and the prototypes and the deceptive methods that she's used to sell stock in the vehicles and the brochures that make claims that are definitely not true. All these things about the Dale, I mean, it just shows you that, you know, I don't know. It just shows you that this lady from the very beginning was nothing but no good for this guy, for this Dale Clift guy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it shows you that, you know, all along there really wasn't ever the plan to build a production vehicle, I don't think. In her mind, it was just a matter of bilking people out of this investment, out of getting the funds built up and then leaving town.
At least, yeah, that's how it seems. I don't know. It's very difficult to say what somebody's intentions are because those take place in your mind, but the actions are entirely the actions of someone who is just out to defraud people.
And all along, she said the big three are out to get her. You know, she's going to crush Detroit. She's going to rule it like a queen is what she said, you know, along the way. So,
right.
You know, she was definitely, playing the, I don't know, the martyr, I guess, you know, that she was just, you know, another sacrifice.
Can I read the, do you mind if I read the review from Car and Driver?
Sure.
Okay. So Car and Driver, of course, you guys remember we mentioned Mike Salisbury, another person working for Car and Driver, writes a recap about the vehicle, upon which Liz Carmichael has staked her claim to fame. He says it had an Onan portable generator engine fed by a lawnmower carburetor stuck on the end of a sloppily welded lead pipe. The rear end was an old Ford differential cut in half mounted to one wheel. The transmission, a Toyota automatic, was stuck into the rear end with no drive shaft. It was literally held together with baling wire and coat hangers. It was just really gross.
Oh my gosh. What a description.
For a technical magazine like Car and Driver, at least a magazine that should be able to articulate a lot of this stuff, for them to end on, it was just really gross.
An engine that was had a lawnmower carburetor stuck on the end of a sloppily welded lead pipe. That's funny. All of this is funny.
Drive shaft.
I mean, oh my gosh. And this is the car that they're presenting to Car and Driver to drum up attention. And how the heck did they get on the floor of the LA Auto Show with this car? How did they do that? That's amazing.
Persuasiveness.
I guess very, very persuasive. Leaders. Now, okay, this whole story isn't over yet because now Carmichael was eventually convicted of 26 counts of fraud.
Took the jury 16 days, by the way.
I don't know why. 26 counts of fraud. Now, for some weird station, a local television station posted bail of $50,000 on her behalf. And I don't know why that happened, but of course she fled. You know, she exhausted her appeals and she fled. And where did she go to, Ben? She went, they found her in Dale, Texas, of all places.
Hey,
eventually. But this is after, and this is another weird twist in this. This is after, an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, you know, the NBC true crime show that had Robert Stack.
Huge fan, by the way.
I am too. They profiled Liz Carmichael, or, what was his name? Jerry something?
Jerry Dean Michaels. And this, she was on the run for 9 years. So it wasn't until 89.
That show was so effective, by the
way. Yeah.
Within 2 weeks, they captured Liz Carmichael again, who is now known as Catherine Elizabeth Johnson.
Right.
In Dale, Texas, which I find very humorous.
She was a florist at this point.
Yeah, florist. And, they said that she had some kids living with her at the time, I believe. And this is it's another twist, Ben. There's all these twists to it. Now, they said that, you know, once she served her time, finally, she was arrested 2 weeks after the show aired, and she was sent to prison in California. So she returns to Austin after serving her time, and she's what they called the mastermind behind a lucrative scheme that employed a team of homeless men to sell roses on the street corner.
I just want to point out that I don't think that's illegal,
I don't think so, but it's like one of these, like, fringes of society thing, you know, like she's operating on the very edge, you know, like, is that legal? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. She's hiring homeless people to sell roses on the side of the road.
Yeah.
I doubt if she's got all the licensing necessary or any of that.
And I have an extra twist at the very end of this.
Okay. That's fine.
Just for the very end.
At the very end. Okay. That's fine. But she says, some reports say that she may have passed away in 2004 in Austin, Texas.
Right.
Now, that's some reports, and that's not really confirmed by any means, but some people think that she's still hanging around, that she's maybe still alive. Okay. Now, I guess we should talk about the cars. Now, did you want to have that one last thing, Ben, before we talk about where the cars are now?
I'm going to wait till the very end.
The very end. Okay, so let's talk about where the Dale cars are now, because we've got to the point where, you know, the founder of the company now has passed away. Dale Clift, he eventually died, I think, in 1981, I believe it was. And they didn't really mention how or why or anything like that.
Right.
Could have been old age. I'm not sure what his age was at the time. But we're getting to the point where, you know, now they've got these properties. They've got three vehicles.
Right, yeah. And we know that two are in the hands of private collectors.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one in the Peterson Auto Museum out there in Los Angeles. However, the one in the Peterson Museum, is the mock-up, Scott.
Yeah, that's the mock-up vehicle. That was the one that was actually in the Encino, California office.
It's a famous 4x4.
Yeah, that's the one. Now, this one has, I guess it has an interior, but no drivetrain. And I think it's not typically on display. It's mainly stored in the basement, you know, the basement storage area. Sometimes they bring it out. But again, this is the mock-up vehicle. Now, the second one that we know about was sold in an LA auction, I guess, to a classic car collector. His name is Bill Maton. And Bill Maton, I guess, has an extensive collection of Dale car memorabilia, which is an odd collection to have, really.
Right.
But I guess he was in the area at the time when all this was going down, and he's a big car collector. So, you know, notable, obscure things like this kind of catches attention as being valuable someday. And he picked up one of the cars at an auction in L.A. at some point. And this was the prototype car. This is the one that barely ran, but the one that did run.
Right, right.
Okay. And then there's the last one. And the last one is in Bill Smith's Museum of American Speed. And this is they call it a very crude car. There's no interior to this one.
Yep.
And this one was actually found on a radiator shop's rotating pole out front, like as a display car. You know how they sometimes put a car on a pole
right
outside, just a shell of a vehicle. And this Dale was apparently on this radiator shop's display pole for a long, long time before someone said, hey, that's a piece of, you know, automobile history.
That's so sad.
Let's take it down. And I guess this Bill Smith bought it. And, that's the three cars. That's all they have. Now, Dale Clift's original car, the original three wheeler, the one that, you know, was
the best working genesis
of this whole thing, yeah. You know, the one that had the Naga hide exterior. I think that the late 1970s, the thing was pretty much just falling apart. And as Dale Clift died in 1981, they just simply lost track of it. They don't know where it ended up. You know, if it just fell apart and it ended up in a scrapyard somewhere, or if somebody has it somewhere.
Right.
You know, maybe in a garage. I don't know. Kind of interesting, you know, twist to this whole thing. Another little twist, I guess, is that one of the, Southern California hot rod guys, his name is Bill Moon. I think a lot of people will know the name Bill Moon.
Right.
He bought, the Seas Dale, or one of the ones that, you know, the, security commissions or whoever was going after the corporation there. He bought one of the Dales and the molds along with it, the one that went to Bill Smith. Bill Smith is in, I think it's in Lincoln, he's in Lincoln, Nebraska, but this guy was in Southern California when he bought it, and no one knew what was going on at the time. So Bill Moon buys this and the molds for the car, not knowing that it's going to go to Bill Smith. They said that Bill wanted to create a kit car version of this vehicle, like a dune buggy version of the car, and he's going to sell it for $800 for each one, but it didn't pan out because have you seen the photos of the Dale, Ben?
Yeah.
Not a very attractive car, really. I mean, it doesn't have a whole lot going for it style-wise.
Right. It's kind of a car you would buy for its abilities if those were true.
Yeah. So there's this real twisted history to this vehicle. I mean, there's so much that goes on with this. And I'm sure there's another, you know, 10 or 12 little small stories that we're not covering here. Like,
sure.
You know, some of the other vehicles that they were going to produce because they had plans
for Revell.
Yeah. The Revell was another one. Yeah. And there was a, what is it called? The Vanagon?
Yeah. Something like that with a V.
Vanagon or Vanagon maybe.
So yeah, the idea with those was it was all part of the advertising on Carmichael's part to say, we'll start small with this two-seater, and then we'll move up to one that has, what, four-seaters? It was a sedan.
It's part of the ruse, Ben. Yeah,
the ruse.
The Revell was going to be a four-seater. And the Vanagon, I'm not sure what that was exactly, but I'm guessing that it had a van-like look to it. I don't think anybody's ever even seen one. I don't know. Have you ever seen the Vanagon? I haven't.
I saw one photo online of a drawing.
I saw a drawing of the Revell, but I never saw the Vanagon. So I'm going to have to look at that when we get out of here. But, this is part of the ruse. It was all part of the story from the very beginning. Now, when you look back, knowing what you know now, you remember that initial meeting that happened when Dale Clift went out to dinner.
That random meeting.
Where was it? In Burbank or somewhere
right
like that?
Right after the press stories.
Yeah, Ventura Boulevard. Was that meeting planned? Did she set that up with somebody to get in on this cash cow, I guess?
And while you're thinking of that, I'm ready to do that last thing.
What's the last thing?
The rumors of Liz Carmichael's death may have been, as Twain would say, exaggerated.
Really?
Yeah, because the statement of the death in 2004, I could only find a couple of mentions, which is why we had to say reportedly.
Yeah.
And those mentions were on internet forums and stuff. So I didn't see a confirmation. There were other reports as well, I would say of equally negligible validity, that said she was spotted somewhere else in 2009 with a child, like with a kid.
Pretty recent.
Yeah. Very recent, especially considering, you know, her five children from Dallas would be at this point grown-ups, mm-hmm. you know? So we actually don't know what happened to Liz Carmichael.
Mm.
We have people who are reporting different things, but I have not at this point seen I have not at this point seen an obituary, nor have I seen
death certificate or anything like that.
No death certificate, no police report. Nothing.
Interesting. So this whole thing, I mean, there's just so many twists and turns to this story. I mean, the Dale and its transsexual founder, really. Mm-hmm. It's just such a weird, weird story.
Yeah.
I don't know how to even sum all this up, Ben, really. It's just such a strange time in automotive history. And if you look into it, if you look up the Dale, if you mm-hmm. check out some photos of where it is, or if you can go to the Peterson Automotive Museum and see one of these in person, you know, one of the three existing vehicles, I don't know. Just tell us what you think about it, because
yeah.
I'm not that impressed by it, obviously. I mean, I don't think many people really were. Of course, there were the initial 5,000 that invested in it in 1975,
right.
but they were investing in a dream and an idea at the time. Now that we know everything that's gone on with this story, oh man, it makes you want to steer clear of anybody that has any kind of offer like this. I mean, it makes you very skeptical, doesn't it?
Yes.
Very cautious with your checkbook.
And that is where I think we should end the story on this moral. If you are an inventor, if you're an investor, really, if you're anybody, be careful when you hear outrageous claims. If something sounds too good to be true, at least give yourself a second to think about it before you sign away your dreams.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of examples of that on the show.
Sure have.
I mean, through the Snopes, you know, site, and you know, through this book, this Automotive Mysteries, Myths and Rumors Revealed book that we've you know, I guess you know, gathered stories from several times. There's a lot of stories like that in there, so just it's a cautionary tale to anybody.
Yep. And with that, we're ending the show. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this strange and twisted tale. Write to us with suggestions for topics you'd like to cover in the future. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can check out this episode as well as every other podcast we've ever done on our website, carstuffshow.com. And you can send us an email directly. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful fingersticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take more control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.